A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it hits close to home. The last year of his life has been, in his words, insanely chaotic. Two wars with Iran. A newborn son born right after the first ceasefire. A roof leak that spiraled into a landlord dispute and a forced move. And here's the thing. Daniel is someone who loves being busy. He has ADHD. He thrives on engagement. He gets bored sitting around. But this year drove home something he hadn't fully felt before. There's a line between enjoyably busy and I don't have a second to eat. And once you cross it, there's no mistaking it. The specific signal he noticed was that life started losing its joyful elements. Even a single day off, which normally recharges him for a surprisingly long time, stopped being enough. So his question is, does research offer any clues about where that line actually lies? And how much of this is personal preference versus something universal?
That signal Daniel described, life losing its joyful elements, that's not just a poetic phrase, that's a diagnostic clue. When someone who genuinely loves being busy, who needs stimulation, who has ADHD at a high baseline drive, suddenly finds that the things that used to bring joy just don't anymore, that's not burnout in the casual sense. That's what the allostatic load literature calls a warning sign, that your stress response systems have stopped returning to baseline.
What I find striking is that he frames it as someone who already knew himself well. This wasn't a slow creep he didn't notice. He could feel the line. He just couldn't stop himself from crossing it because of the circumstances. Wars, a newborn, a forced move, didn't give him a choice.
Right, and that's where the autonomy piece becomes critical. The BPS Research Digest published findings in 2021 showing that people are happier when they're busy, even if they'd prefer to be idle, but only if the busyness is chosen. The moment it becomes obligatory, the happiness benefit evaporates entirely. Daniel's situation is a textbook case of forced busyness without the autonomy buffer.
We're not talking about someone who overscheduled their social calendar and feels a bit frazzled. We're talking about someone whose external circumstances removed every recovery window for months on end. And the thing that broke wasn't his productivity, it was his capacity for joy.
And that's what makes this worth unpacking. In a culture that glorifies hustle and treats busyness as a status symbol. There's a great paper on this by Sylvia Beleza and colleagues from 2017 in the Journal of Consumer Research. We rarely stop to ask where the line actually is between enjoyably productive and dangerously overloaded. But the research says that line is real, it's measurable, and it varies significantly by personality.
Where do we even start with this? Because Daniel's question has layers. He's asking about the line itself, about individual differences, about why a single day off can sometimes be enough and sometimes not. And underneath all of it, there's this unspoken question. If someone who loves being busy can hit a wall this hard, what does that say about the rest of us?
I think we start by acknowledging that busyness itself isn't the villain here. That's actually one of the biggest misconceptions floating around in wellness culture. This idea that being busy is always bad for you, that the goal is to do as little as possible. The data doesn't support that at all.
The data says humans are weird about idleness.
There's a classic study from 2010 by Shi and colleagues at the University of Chicago that I think about constantly. They gave participants a choice. They could either wait 15 minutes doing nothing and then eat a chocolate, or they could walk 12 minutes to a different location to drop off the chocolate, walk back, and then eat it. Same outcome, they get the chocolate either way. But the twist was, in one condition, they were told the chocolate they'd receive at the distant location was identical. In another condition, they were told it was different. Milk chocolate versus dark chocolate, so there was a justification for walking.
If the chocolate is identical, walking is just pointless effort.
And here's what happened. When there was a justification, different chocolate, most people walked. But when the chocolate was identical and walking served no purpose whatsoever, a significant number of people still chose to walk. They invented busyness to avoid 15 minutes of idleness.
Which is absurd on its face. You're doing work to get the exact same reward you could have had for free, just so you don't have to sit still.
That's the point. Humans have a deep-seated aversion to idleness. We will create busyness for ourselves even when it serves no rational purpose. The researchers called this the busyness instinct, and it suggests that being engaged, being effective, doing something, is wired into us at a pretty fundamental level. From an evolutionary perspective, it makes sense. An organism that sits around doing nothing when it could be gathering resources, building shelter, or strengthening social bonds is an organism that's going to get outcompeted.
Then the question becomes, if busyness feels good because it's wired into us, why does it suddenly stop feeling good? What flips the switch?
This is where Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's work on flow becomes really useful. Flow is that state where you're completely absorbed in what you're doing, time disappears, and the challenge of the task perfectly matches your skill level. It feels amazing. But flow has very specific conditions. If the challenge exceeds your skill, you don't get flow. You get anxiety. If your skill exceeds the challenge, you don't get flow. You get boredom. So the experience of being busy exists on this spectrum. At the right level of demand, it's flow. Push past that, and it tips into distress.
That tipping point, from flow to distress, that's what Daniel's describing, isn't it? The moment where being busy stops feeling like engagement and starts feeling like drowning.
And what makes it particularly tricky is that the line isn't fixed. It moves depending on a whole set of factors. Your personality, your circumstances, whether the busyness is chosen or imposed, how much recovery you're getting.
Which brings us to the U-shaped curve. I was reading a synthesis by Chiki Davis in Psychology Today from 2022, and she pulls together research showing that happiness and busyness follow this U-shape. Too little activity, you get boredom and dissatisfaction. Too much, you get stress and burnout. The sweet spot is somewhere in the middle.
Here's the part that doesn't get enough attention. That curve is asymmetrical. The drop-off on the too-busy side is steeper and more harmful than the drop-off on the too-idle side. Being understimulated is unpleasant, but being overextended without recovery is damaging.
The cost of overwork is higher than the cost of underwork.
And that asymmetry is what makes Daniel's experience so telling. He's not someone who's mildly overscheduled. He's someone who's been pushed far onto the right side of that curve for months, and the thing that broke first wasn't his ability to function. It was his ability to feel joy.
That's the diagnostic clue you mentioned. The joy erosion.
And it maps perfectly onto what we know about allostatic load. Allostatic load is the cumulative wear and tear on the body from chronic stress without adequate recovery. Under normal circumstances, your stress response activates, you deal with the stressor, and then your body returns to baseline. Cortisol drops, heart rate normalizes, the parasympathetic system kicks in. But when stressors are relentless and recovery windows disappear, your system stops returning to baseline. You're running at an elevated stress level constantly.
That's not just feeling tired. That's physiological damage accumulating.
Allostatic load has been linked to cardiovascular disease, immune dysfunction, cognitive decline, metabolic disorders. It's not a metaphor. It's measurable wear and tear. And one of the early psychological signs is exactly what Daniel described. Anhedonia, the loss of the ability to experience pleasure from activities that used to be enjoyable.
When Daniel says life has lost its joyful elements, he's not being dramatic. He's describing a real physiological state.
He's describing a symptom of allostatic overload. And what makes it insidious is that for someone like Daniel, who loves being busy, who has ADHD and needs stimulation, the early warning signs are easy to miss because they're masked by the genuine enjoyment of activity. By the time the joy disappears, you're already deep into the danger zone.
That's the thing about crossing the line, which he mentioned specifically. He said it's remarkably easy to cross, but once you do, there's no mistaking it.
That's because the line isn't a single event. It's a threshold. You don't cross it in one bad day. You cross it through an accumulation of days, weeks, months, where recovery never quite catches up to demand. And because it's gradual, you often don't notice you're approaching the threshold until you're already on the other side.
Like boiling a frog. Except the frog is you, and the water is your life falling apart.
I was going to reach for a more clinical analogy, but yes, that's the general idea.
We've got the evolutionary drive to avoid idleness. We've got the flow channel between anxiety and boredom. We've got the asymmetrical U-curve, where too much is worse than too little. And we've got allostatic load as the mechanism that explains why crossing the line is so damaging. That's the universal picture. But Daniel also asked about individual differences. Why do some people thrive on busyness while others crash?
That's where personality comes in. There's a 2025 study from BMC Psychology. The DOI is 10.1186/S40359-025-036-54-4 that looks specifically at how personality traits moderate the relationship between busyness and well-being. The findings are pretty striking.
What did they find?
Two traits in particular matter a lot: neuroticism and extroversion. People high in neuroticism hit the too-busy threshold faster. They experience distress at lower levels of demand, and once they cross the line, recovery takes longer. Their systems are more reactive to stress and slower to return to baseline. On the flip side, people high in extroversion have a wider sweet spot. They can tolerate more activity before tipping into overload, and they tend to recover faster. Extroversion is associated with higher baseline positive affect, which seems to act as a buffer.
Where does ADHD fit into this? Daniel mentioned it specifically.
ADHD complicates the picture in interesting ways. People with ADHD often have a higher baseline need for stimulation. The understimulated brain is uncomfortable, which is why boredom can feel almost physically painful. So there's a genuine drive toward busyness that's neurobiological, not just preference. But ADHD also often comes with challenges around sustained attention, emotional regulation, and executive function, which means that non-autonomous busyness, being forced to sustain attention on things you didn't choose, is particularly draining.
ADHD creates a narrower sweet spot in a different way. Higher need for stimulation on one side, lower tolerance for forced busyness on the other.
The optimal zone is real, but it's shaped differently depending on your neurobiology. And Daniel's experience maps onto this perfectly. He needs engagement, he seeks it out, but when circumstances remove his autonomy and force sustained attention on stressful, externally imposed demands, the cost is higher.
Which brings us back to autonomy. You mentioned the BPS finding earlier. The chosen busyness boosts well-being, but forced busyness erodes it. That seems like the linchpin of this whole thing.
It really is. The 2021 BPS Research Digest piece synthesized findings showing that autonomy is the key moderator. When people feel in control of their activity, even if they're very active, the stress burden is lower. When they feel like their activity is being imposed on them, the same volume of busyness is far more damaging.
Daniel's situation: two wars, a newborn, a landlord dispute, a forced move. None of that was chosen. Every single major stressor was externally imposed.
He wasn't overscheduling himself with hobbies and projects he was excited about. He was responding to emergencies, one after another, with no recovery window between them. That's the worst-case scenario from the perspective of the autonomy buffer. There's no buffer at all.
Even someone who loves being busy, who has a high tolerance for activity, who needs stimulation, even that person can be broken by forced busyness without recovery.
Not can be. Daniel's describing the aftermath in real time. He's moving boxes on his second weekend in a row, and he's noticing that the things that used to bring joy don't anymore. That's not weakness. That's a predictable physiological response to sustained allostatic load.
There's something almost reassuring about that, in a grim way. It's not a personal failing, it's biology.
It is biology. And that's actually one of the most important takeaways from the research. When you hit the wall, it's not because you're not tough enough or resilient enough or organized enough. It's because you're a human with a nervous system that has limits, and you've exceeded them.
Where does recovery fit into this? Daniel mentioned something interesting, that even a single day off can recharge his batteries for a surprisingly long time. But that stopped working when the stretches without downtime got too long.
This connects to what the research calls recovery micro-moments. There was a piece in Psychology Today this February, The Productivity Paradox, that argued the key isn't total hours of downtime, but the frequency and quality of recovery moments throughout the day. Even 5 to 10 minutes of genuine disengagement, no phone, no work thoughts, no task switching, can reset cortisol levels and restore cognitive function.
It's not just about the big breaks. It's about the small ones, too.
The small ones may actually be more important for preventing allostatic load from accumulating in the first place. Think of it like a pressure valve. If you're releasing pressure regularly throughout the day, the system stays manageable. If you never release pressure and just wait for one big release on the weekend, you're already in trouble.
Daniel's situation is that even the big releases disappeared. He went from having occasional days off to having 0 days off for extended stretches. No micro moments, no macro moments, just sustained demand.
That's the allostatic load scenario I described. The system never gets a chance to return to baseline. Cortisol stays elevated. The parasympathetic nervous system never gets to do its recovery work. And over time, the psychological symptoms emerge. Anhedonia, emotional exhaustion, the sense that life has lost its color.
You said anhedonia. That's the clinical term for what Daniel described as life losing its joyful elements.
And it's one of the core symptoms of burnout and depression. The fact that Daniel can name it so clearly. I noticed that the things that used to bring me joy don't anymore, and that makes me sad. That's actually a sign of insight. A lot of people in allostatic overload don't even notice they've lost the capacity for joy until someone else points it out, or until they crash completely. So the fact that he's noticing it now, while he's still functional, while he's still able to reflect on it and ask these questions, that's valuable. That's the early warning system working.
Even if the early warning system is basically a flashing red light that says you're already in trouble.
The early warning system for allostatic overload isn't great at prevention. It's more of a you're already here notification. But it's still useful, because the sooner you recognize it, the sooner you can start recovery. And the BMC psychology study I mentioned found that recovery takes longer for people high in neuroticism, so the earlier you catch it, the better.
We've established the mechanism. We've established that the line is real, that it's partly universal and partly personal, that autonomy is the critical variable, and that Daniel's experience is basically a case study in what happens when forced busyness meets zero recovery time. What I'm still wondering about is the cultural dimension. You mentioned the Beleza paper on busyness as a status symbol.
Sylvia Beleza and colleagues, 2017, Journal of Consumer Research. They found that in Western cultures, particularly in the United States, being busy signals high status. It suggests you're in demand, you're important, you're competent. There's a social pressure to be busy, or at least to appear busy, because idleness is associated with low status.
Which is the exact opposite of what was true for most of human history, where being idle was a sign of wealth because it meant you didn't have to work.
The status signal flipped. Historically, leisure was the status symbol. Only the rich could afford to do nothing. Now, busyness is the status symbol. Only the important people are constantly in demand. It's a complete inversion, and it creates a cultural environment where people feel pressure to be busy even when it's harming them.
That pressure interacts with the autonomy question in an interesting way. If you're choosing to be busy because you want to be, that's one thing. But if you're choosing to be busy because you feel like you should be, because not being busy would make you look lazy or unsuccessful, that's not really chosen, is it?
It's a fascinating gray area. On the surface, it looks like chosen busyness. You're not being forced by an external circumstance like a war or a landlord dispute. But the internal pressure, the cultural expectation, the fear of being seen as idle, that's a form of coercion. It's just coming from inside the house.
The autonomy buffer might be thinner than it appears. A lot of what we call chosen busyness might actually be socially pressured busyness, wearing a choice costume.
That's one of the things that makes this research so tricky to apply in practice. The line between chosen and forced isn't always clear. Daniel's case is extreme. Wars and newborns and forced moves are unambiguously external impositions. But for a lot of people, the forces that push them past the line are more subtle. Cultural expectations, workplace norms, internalized beliefs about productivity and self-worth.
Which means part of the work of finding your optimal busyness level is getting honest about why you're busy. Is it because the activity energizes you and aligns with your values? Or is it because you're afraid of what it would mean about you if you slowed down?
That's a question worth sitting with, and I think it connects back to something Daniel said that I want to highlight. He said he loves engaging in hobbies. He tends to get bored sitting around. He has ADHD. That's genuine, internally motivated busyness. That's not status signaling. That's someone whose brain needs engagement.
Even that person hit the wall.
Even that person, which tells you something important about the limits of the autonomy buffer. Chosen busyness is protective, but it's not invincible. If the volume of demand is high enough and the recovery windows are absent for long enough, even the most internally motivated person will eventually hit allostatic overload.
Autonomy is a buffer, not a shield.
A buffer, not a shield. That's a good way to put it.
Let's dig into the individual differences piece more. You mentioned the BMC psychology study on neuroticism and extroversion. What else do we know about why some people thrive on busyness while others crash?
The BMC study gave us neuroticism and extroversion as the big moderators, but there's another layer here that I think is crucial for understanding Daniel's question. The distinction isn't just about how much busyness you can tolerate. It's about what kind of busyness drains you versus what kind fills you up.
Right, because Daniel's not saying all busyness broke him. He's saying this specific kind, forced, relentless, no recovery, broke him. The hobbies and the engagement he normally loves weren't the problem.
And that maps onto something Cheeky Davis highlights in that 2022 Psychology Today synthesis. She draws a distinction between what she calls purposeful busyness and chaotic overload. Purposeful busyness is activity that feels meaningful, aligned with your values, within your control. Chaotic overload is activity that feels reactive, fragmented, imposed from outside. Same volume of activity, completely different psychological experience.
It's not just chosen versus forced, it's meaningful versus meaningless.
The two often overlap. Chosen activity tends to feel meaningful. Forced activity tends to feel meaningless, or at least disconnected from your own priorities. But you can also have chosen activity that feels empty. The person who voluntarily overschedules their social calendar with events they don't actually care about, just to avoid being alone.
Which loops back to your point about getting honest about why you're busy. Are you filling your time with things that matter to you, or are you just filling time?
That's where the U-curve gets its asymmetry. The drop-off on the too idle side is real. Boredom, rumination, the sense that you're wasting your life. But the drop-off on the too busy side isn't just unpleasant, it's physiologically damaging. That's the allostatic load we talked about. So the cost of erring on the side of too much is higher than the cost of erring on the side of too little.
Which is a useful heuristic. If you're going to guess wrong, guess toward less.
Because the See Chocolate study reminds us that people will admit busyness to avoid idleness. Complete inactivity is aversive for most people. The goal isn't to do nothing. It's to find a zone where activity feels like engagement rather than assault.
That zone shifts. Daniel mentioned that a single day off normally recharges him for a surprisingly long time, but it stopped working when the stretches without downtime got too long. That suggests the recovery system has a kind of saturation point.
Think of it like a battery. Under normal circumstances, a full day of rest might bring you back to 90% charge, and that's enough to get you through a week. But if you've been running at 5% for months, a single day might only bring you to 30%. You need multiple recovery cycles to get back to baseline.
If you never get those cycles, because the wars keep coming, because the newborn needs constant attention, because the move eats every weekend, you're operating from an increasingly depleted baseline. The recovery you do get is never enough to catch up.
That's the allostatic load accumulation in a nutshell. Each stressor depletes you a little more, and without adequate recovery between stressors, the depletion compounds. Eventually, you're running on empty, and that's when the psychological symptoms emerge. The anhedonia, the emotional exhaustion, the sense that life has lost its color.
Daniel's question, where's the line, has a two-part answer. The universal part is that the line is where demand consistently exceeds recovery, triggering allostatic overload. The personal part is that where exactly that happens depends on your neurobiology, your personality, and whether the busyness is purposeful or chaotic.
I'd add a third piece. Context matters enormously. Living in a war zone, having a newborn, being forced to move, these aren't just busyness. These are existential stressors. They activate threat responses that ordinary work stress doesn't. The same number of hours of activity in a safe, stable environment might feel manageable, while in a high-threat environment, they feel crushing.
Because your nervous system is already doing background work that you can't see. Processing threat, maintaining vigilance, managing uncertainty. That's cognitive load that doesn't show up on the calendar, but absolutely counts toward the allostatic total.
And that's why Daniel's experience, while extreme, illuminates something universal. Most of us aren't living through wars, but many of us are living through periods where the background stress is higher than we realize. A toxic workplace, a health scare, caring for an aging parent, financial precarity. The busyness that felt fine last year suddenly feels unbearable, and we don't understand why.
Because we're only counting the visible load. The meetings, the deadlines, the boxes to move. We're not counting the invisible load of just holding it together in a stressful environment.
That invisible load is real. It consumes cognitive resources. It activates stress pathways. It contributes to allostatic load. The research is clear on this. Chronic background stress makes you more vulnerable to acute stress. Your threshold for too busy actually drops when your context is more demanding.
The line isn't just personal. It's situational. The same person with the same personality and the same volume of activity might be fine in one context and drowning in another.
Which is actually a hopeful finding, in a way. It means that if you can change your context, even in small ways, you can shift your threshold. You're not stuck with a fixed capacity. The BMC study found that recovery interventions, even brief ones, can expand the sweet spot.
It's not just about knowing your limits. It's about knowing that your limits are malleable.
And that connects to the recovery micro-moments idea from the productivity paradox piece. If your context is high stress and you can't change the big things, you can't stop the war, you can't make the newborn sleep through the night, you can still insert small recovery windows. 5 minutes of genuine disengagement. 10 minutes without a phone. A walk around the block with no agenda.
Daniel mentioned that even a single day off normally recharges him for a surprisingly long time. That suggests his baseline recovery system actually works pretty well under normal circumstances. It's just been overwhelmed by the sheer volume and duration of the demand.
That's an important diagnostic distinction. Someone whose recovery system works well under normal conditions but fails under extreme conditions is in a different category from someone whose recovery system is chronically impaired. Daniel's experience suggests his system is functional, just overloaded. The fix isn't to overhaul his entire approach to life. It's to protect the recovery windows that he already knows work for him.
Which is harder than it sounds when circumstances keep eating those windows.
But naming the problem is the first step. And Daniel's doing that. He's noticing the joy erosion. He's identifying the pattern, long stretches without a single day of downtime, and he's asking what the research says. That's not someone who's given up. That's someone who's trying to understand the mechanism so he can work with it.
The mechanism, as we've laid out, is pretty clear. Humans have an aversion to idleness that drives us toward activity. That activity feels good when it's in the flow channel. Challenge matching skill. It starts to feel bad when demand exceeds capacity and the HPA axis kicks into sustained stress response. If the stress is chronic and recovery is absent, allostatic load accumulates. The psychological signal that you've crossed the line is often anhedonia, the loss of joy, and the whole process is moderated by personality, neurobiology, autonomy, and context.
That's the architecture. And what I appreciate about Daniel's question is that he's not asking for a magic number. He's not saying, tell me exactly how many hours of busyness is optimal. He's asking about the line, where it is, why it moves, and how to recognize when you've crossed it.
Because once you've crossed it, as he said, there's no mistaking it. The question is whether you can catch it earlier next time.
Let's sit with the social dimension for a moment, because I think it explains why so many people miss the line entirely. Beleza and her colleagues documented this in 2017. Busyness has become a status symbol. In Western cultures, if you tell someone you're slammed, you're signaling that you're in demand. If you say you have plenty of free time, people wonder if you're underemployed.
The humble brag of exhaustion. I'm so busy, as a way of saying I'm so important.
And the researchers found this effect was strongest in the United States, but it's spreading. They ran experiments where they showed participants descriptions of people with different lifestyles. The person who was described as constantly busy, always on the go, working long hours, that person was rated as higher status than the person who had leisure time, even when both were described as having the same income.
Busyness itself, independent of actual achievements, signals competence.
And that creates a perverse incentive. If appearing busy raises your social standing, people will perform busyness even when it's harming them. They'll overschedule, refuse to delegate, avoid taking breaks, not because the activity is meaningful, but because the appearance of constant activity is socially rewarded.
Which means the cultural pressure to be busy is itself a form of forced busyness. You're not being forced by a specific boss or a specific emergency. You're being forced by the fear of what people will think if you slow down.
That's where the autonomy buffer gets complicated. On paper, the person who voluntarily works 60 hours a week is choosing to be busy. But if that choice is driven by social pressure, by the fear of being seen as lazy or unimportant, how autonomous is it really?
It's autonomy with an asterisk. The choice is technically yours, but the menu of socially acceptable options is so narrow that it barely feels like a choice.
Which brings us back to Daniel's situation in Israel. Living in a war zone adds another layer entirely. This isn't social pressure to appear busy, this is actual survival pressure. Missile sirens, military service, the constant background hum of existential threat. The busyness isn't performative, it's imposed by reality.
That kind of forced busyness, the kind where you literally cannot opt out, is qualitatively different from even the most intense workplace crunch. Because there's no fantasy of control. You can't tell yourself, if I just manage my time better, this will ease up. The external circumstances are non-negotiable.
The BPS findings from 2021 are especially relevant here. They showed that forced busyness lacks the autonomy buffer entirely. It's not just that forced busyness is less pleasant than chosen busyness. It's that the same volume of activity is more damaging when it's forced. The stress response is stronger, recovery is slower, and the psychological toll is heavier.
Daniel's year. Two wars. A newborn. A forced move. That's three layers of non-negotiable demand stacked on top of each other. Each one individually would be a major stressor. Combined, with no recovery between them, it's basically a masterclass in allostatic overload.
The newborn piece is worth highlighting separately because it's a special category of forced busyness. A baby doesn't respect your schedule, your personality, or your need for stimulation. The demands are relentless, unpredictable, and often feel meaningless in the moment. Changing the 12th diaper of the day doesn't exactly deliver a sense of purposeful engagement.
It's also not optional. You can't negotiate with a newborn. You can't tell them you need a recovery micro moment.
And that's where the recovery micro-moments research from the productivity paradox piece becomes both important and frustrating. The research says 5 to 10 minutes of genuine disengagement can reset cortisol levels. But if you're caring for a newborn in a war zone while coordinating a move, where exactly do you find those 5 minutes?
You don't. That's the point. The research describes an ideal scenario that simply doesn't exist for someone in Daniel's circumstances. And that's not a failure of the research. It's a failure of the conditions. The science is saying here's what you need, and reality is saying you can't have it.
Which is why the tipping point phenomenon is so important to understand. When Daniel says it's remarkably easy to cross the line, but once you do, there's no mistaking it, he's describing the allostatic load threshold. The body and brain can compensate for a long time. You can run on cortisol and adrenaline and sheer willpower for weeks, sometimes months. But the compensation isn't infinite.
The crash, when it comes, isn't subtle. You don't wonder if you've crossed the line.
The joy erosion is the tell. Daniel named it perfectly. When you notice that the things that used to light you up just don't anymore. Not because you're tired of them, not because you've outgrown them, but because the capacity for joy itself seems to have gone offline. That's not burnout in the casual, I need a vacation sense. That's a neurological state.
The scary part is that recovery from that state isn't just a matter of getting one good night's sleep. The BMC psychology study confirmed that once you're in allostatic overload, recovery takes longer, especially for people high in neuroticism. The system has been running hot for so long that it's forgotten how to return to baseline.
There's a concept in stress physiology called hysteresis. It's the idea that a system's current state depends on its history, not just its current inputs. If you've been chronically stressed for months, your cortisol regulation doesn't just snap back the moment the stressor disappears. The system has been recalibrated. It takes time, sometimes a lot of time, to recalibrate back.
The line isn't just a threshold you cross. It's a threshold that moves behind you. Once you're on the other side, the way back is longer than the way in.
It's why prevention matters so much more than cure. Catching yourself before you cross the line is dramatically easier than clawing your way back after you've crossed it.
Which, again, is almost impossible in Daniel's circumstances. You can't prevent what you can't control.
No, but you can recognize what's happening and adjust your expectations. One of the most damaging things people do in forced busyness situations is blame themselves for not handling it better. They think, I should be able to manage this. Other people have it worse. Why am I struggling? And that self-blame adds a whole additional layer of stress on top of the external demands.
The meta-stress of feeling like you're feeling it stress.
And the research is clear that self-compassion during high-stress periods actually reduces allostatic load. Just acknowledging this is an objectively impossible situation and I'm doing the best I can changes the physiological stress response. It doesn't fix the circumstances, but it removes the secondary stress of self-judgment.
Part of the answer to Daniel's question, where's the line and how do you recognize it, is that the line announces itself through joy erosion and the appropriate response isn't to push harder or to blame yourself. It's to recognize that you're in allostatic overload and treat recovery as non-negotiable, even if you can only get it in microdoses.
The microdose piece is encouraging. The productivity paradox research suggests that even very brief recovery moments, if they're genuine, meaning no phone, no task switching, no mental rehearsal of your to-do list, can have measurable effects on cortisol and cognitive function. You don't need a week at a spa. You need permission to disengage for 5 real minutes.
The permission is the hard part, especially for someone like Daniel, who loves being busy, who has ADHD, who's wired for engagement. Giving yourself permission to do nothing for 5 minutes can feel almost physically uncomfortable.
And that discomfort is worth pushing through, because the alternative is the joy erosion he's already experiencing. The 5 minutes of discomfort now versus the months of anhedonia later, that's the trade-off.
Let's get practical. Daniel's question, at its core, is what do I actually do with this information?
I think the first actionable piece is the simplest. Identify your personal threshold. Not the universal threshold, not what some wellness blog says, but yours. The BMC psychology study gives us the framework, neurotic.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long-eared host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.